Hi, sir. Julia Duthwaite. Julia is a professor of French at the University of Notre Dame, the recipient of several prestigious awards, including an NEH fellowship and a Guggenheim. She is the author of three books, Exotic Women, Literary Heroines, and Cultural Strategies in the Ancien Régime France, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 1992, The Wild Girl, Natural Man, and the Monster, Dangerous Experiments in the Age of Enlightenment, published by Chicago in 2002, and most recently, The Frankenstein of 1790, and Other Lost Chapters from Revolutionary France, published by Chicago in 2012. She is also, of course, the author of a large number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters on 18th century French literature, and her current book project is titled Financiers We Have Known, The Art and Literature of Finance from Regency to Restoration. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a short amount of time, and as I had earlier said to our speakers, I was going to just do it off the cuff, which I think is really a good way to do it. It certainly woke me up this morning. There are many interesting things that wove through these papers. Thank you very much, by the way, panelists and chair, for coming forward with these interesting works. I just have a few little things, nothing really coherent, just a few ideas that came out as you spoke. So I'll just quickly say what I wrote, a few little ideas, because I really wanted to have it more of a dialogue with you, the audience. But I just wanted to say for Tabitha that it was very, very, very interesting. I had no idea about any of that stuff. And I just thought, as a literary person, what came to my mind immediately with your speaking of this woman trying to buy bread walking around the streets of Dinan was the story from Balzac, An Episode Sous la Terreur, where this elderly nun goes out on a snowy night and buys some hosts from a clandestine bakery. And she spends her last louis d'or to do that. And there's no biting of the coin in that story, and maybe that's significant, that the bakers know her, and she's a member of the clergy, you know, they have money. So the whole, when I've taught that story, I've never even actually thought to stop and go, oh, this is a little old woman in the dark, and the bakers have total trust in her, and total trust in her money. And so that might be something interesting to think about, or as you teach this material, it could be something, it's a good story, it's short, it's a detective story, students like it. So that was my little thought for you. For Andrew, very, very enjoyable paper. Thank you very much. And I just wanted to throw out the melancholic aspect of the market, the unregulated being dangerous, the regulated being perhaps suppressing, you know, dynamic energies. And I was just curious to know more about the emotional aspect of the commerce that you described there, which leads me to the third paper by Bassano, also excellent work on Manon Lescaut, very much enjoyed. And, of course, this raises a lot of issues about, I thought it was very interesting how you had the quote above where Manon herself is speaking, but, of course, through the filter of the man of quality. And she says, je travaille pour rendre le chevalier riche et heureux. And I was just thinking about the melancholy aspect of commerce. Well, okay, she's selling her, well, she's basically having sex with men to make her lover happy. It's like, well, how would the man feel about that? Would that be du commerce or, you know, plutôt commerce mélancolique? It's very strange. I've always found that story so strange that he goes along with it and he sort of sits at home happily waiting for her to come back from basically having sex with strange men. And that's all fine. It's very odd, and I thought it might be interesting to think about those layers of emotion. So the man of quality reporting that she does this, you know, en toute simplicité. It just sort of boggles the mind of the modern sensibility anyway. And then quickly to touch on Dean Ferguson's excellent work on the chiffonnier. I was very curious because I'm always trying to go back and forth with the present day and to the past. And I really was very intrigued by your comment at the very beginning about how the trade among chiffonnier or rag pickers could be seen as a way that the local and also, as you showed, the national and even international International Commerce was helping local, very, very poor people, and probably notably women, make a living without resorting to prostitution, just, you know, justement. But I was curious about the discourse about that. You know, and often when you read about micro lending, it is considered a haphazard, imperfect solution because the market quickly gets glutted as soon as you start offering money for some product in a very tiny market. When people, very poor people, realize that, then they all want to produce that because they want to get the money. Well, what I was curious about the regs, how did the market remain stable so that there wasn't too many rag pickers out there running around trying to get money, you know? Just a question, because it's something in today's economic writing that is controversial because it's not a long-term solution for the people that are not in the system. So those were very, very just sort of ideas thrown out there. But as I said, I'd really rather turn the floor to the audience and have a dialogue with you.
Right. I think we have time for a couple of questions. So anyone has them, please identify yourself as well.
Brian Sandberg. I wanted to come to Dean's paper first. He brought up Lawrence Fontaine. I thought that was very helpful because actually from Tabitha's paper, I was already thinking of Lawrence Fontaine and the circulation of secondhand goods, small commerce, the moral economy of the 18th century. So I was wondering if others of you have also read her work, and if not, how you think about the relationship between the sort of small strategies of the everyday petit commerce and the relationship to value, which seems so critical for all of your papers. Thank you.
I don't know if that was a question directed at me. I think it was directed to everybody else, right? I don't know.
So are literary studies people reading Lawrence Fontaine? Is that pretty much the question? If it's no, then that's fine. If it's
no. I've never heard of that writer.
You want to explain the thesis of that book a little bit, just so that you can encourage them to...
Is it in French or in English? Oh, so it's a woman.
Originally written in French, but now translated. She's one of the leading experts of the colporteur. Oh. That was her thesis turned into a monograph. But she's since written on the moral economy of the 18th century and on value from the 18th century to today. So she's been in a series of debates with people like Piketty and with Claire Croston, who's here at this conference from University of Illinois. But basically, she looks at the strategies of everyday life for people on the margins of society and how things like the circulation of secondhand goods play a role within their economic strategies for survival.
Great, thank you. I think there's another question back.
Oh, I think you had someone wanted to bring that.
We may as well get all the questions in, and then we'll...
Hi, I'm Jennifer Davis at the University of Oklahoma. I actually had a question that kind of tags on to the prior question, but just in terms, it struck me that all four papers really speak to the connection between household economies and national economies. And I wondered if you might kind of bring out what are those connections a little bit more. I just found it really compelling. You know, all four of you really spoke, I thought, beautifully in very specific terms about what is the impact of these activities in terms of the national economy. But your examples are drawn from individual households, many of them. So I was very curious what you might say to that. Thanks.
Well, in my view, what I'm trying to do is connect not just the individual household to the national economy, but to rising consumerism. Usually the argument focuses on either demand or supply, supply being the technologies that transforming the national economy in this period, and then demand being the consumerism that's some arguments some are arguing is driving that industrialization or this transformation of the economy. And I see the rag as an interesting place where they intersect, where you have consumer purchases of clothing items, which then degenerate into rags, which then are returned to the circuit as paper, which then are used for advertising purposes, and then encourage households to purchase. So, I mean, I see this as, I mean, you're absolutely right in saying that connection. That's clearly what I'm trying to get at.
I would say that with respect to the household, absolutely, although the sample that I used for this paper, and maybe even more broadly in the whole chapter, wouldn't really be adequate to say with any great determination that the 18th century looks like an earlier moment in French economic history in which the household held pride of place and sort of center of most production. But with the examples that I do have, it's perfectly clear that counterfeiting is, at least in the lower levels, very much a family affair. That was really striking. And in the case of Marie-Joseph Joris, part of what was interesting was that husband number two was seemingly not at all involved, but the grandson from the previous marriage and, you know, children from the previous marriage were. So that was kind of interesting to think about. At the higher levels, so sort of higher echelons, part of what's so striking about it is that it is this kind of de-differentiated network of specialists in their respective fields, but nevertheless, everything from finance world to metal workers, to, you know, in fact, deserting soldiers and all kinds of really interesting people who come together in this geographically specific space that is on the borders of France, the Holy Roman Empire, as well as in a space where heavy metals are mined. So the whole Liège thing has been a font, quite literally. kind of delight in that way. With respect to value, very much thinking about the Komaroffs, Jesse Shipley, you know, and others who are looking at fakery and the illicit as a place where value is renegotiated. This, they wouldn't use this language, but I would, sort of from below. And where the illicit can, in its own weird ways, have more authority or more authenticity than the real. And this is particularly important in this Regency moment when we see not only the devaluation of metal coin, but also the really first key moment when paper money is brought in a non-war context. So within that framework, thinking about how sovereign entities are responsible for designating value, even as they respond to something like this. Here you have folks who are, there's a great book by someone whose last name is Parsons, and the first name I can't pronounce, but I think it's Yotham. Yotham. The book is brilliant. I mean, every chapter, every word of it was just a delight. It's about the 16th century, but I think that it holds well for the stuff that I've seen so far in the late 17th and into the 18th century. My specific interest is this international stuff and the diplomatic stuff, but I think that the work he does is spot on.
Yeah, I wanted to just add about the distinction between the household economy, the oikos, and what's going on in France. So in Manon Lescaut, the nobles, they do have money matters with inheritance and like very modest affairs of financial transmission. But these types of household economies are very modest in comparison, for example, to the wealth, the bourgeois, the tax collectors. And so the aristocratic characters in Manon Lescaut, they sort of want to go back to an older ethos, the ethos of value, of valeur, For example, that you find in Corneille le Cid, Rodrigue, who's an aristocrat, but he's never fought in war yet. He says, la valeur n'attend point le nombre des années. Value doesn't wait for the number of years. So they're trying to go back to this idea of a value that has to do with a moral economy. So so I think there's all this discourse in Manon Lescaut about the different logics of distinction. There's like valeur that has to do with glory, so very much gesturing back towards Ancien Régime, 17th century ideals, as a way of sort of coping with the new hierarchy, the new economic hierarchy that's coming into place during the Regency.
I'll just make a quick comment then. I'm interested in Diderot's use of the term bonheur, and I was drawing heavily on Anoush Tjajanian's Commerce and Its Discontents, where she makes the point against Hirschman that the term du commerce, you can't find an example of it as such in any century political discourse. I mean, you can find passages that express the concept, but that the term itself, according to Tjajanian, and I'll take your word for that, but on the other hand, the term commerce odieux does appear. So I find that distinction interesting in any case, but it seems to me that just as you can question the expression du commerce, I think you can question whether either du commerce or commerce odieux work to effectively describe Diderot's conception of the ethics of commerce, so to speak. There's the utilitarian side to Diderot, the supreme voyage de Bougainville, his concept of bonheur seems to be very important for his moral dimension of his philosophy. But I think it's particularly important in terms of what he's saying about commerce, because he is connecting bonheur there to what we could, rather in crude terms, call consumer satisfaction. And that is there's an ethical dimension to it, but there's also this more, it connects also to a concept of desire, and, that's something that I think is important to preserve, and I just couldn't touch on that much in this short paper, but yeah.
Okay, I want to thank all our panelists for such a stimulating set of papers.